KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
KPFT 90.1 HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there, folks.
The only upcoming election that any of you need to worry about right now in Harris County is for City of Houston District G. If you don't know if you're in District G, you can go to harrisvotes.com and put in your voter information, and if you get a sample ballot, then you're there. If you don't, you're not. Early voting for that special election ends January 21st, and Election Day is January 25th. The next election for which we'll all sort of be involved is going to be the primary election. The election day for that is March 1st. Now, first thing I want to say is if you qualify for a mail-in ballot, do make sure, A, that you have mailed in your application, and B, that you didn't mail in your application until after January 1st. We'll talk about that a little bit in a couple of minutes. So, the last day to register to vote for the primary is January 31st. You can always register to vote, but to vote in the primary, you have to be registered by January 31st. Early voting by personal appearance will start on Monday, February 14th. The last day to apply for a ballot by mail, and it has to be received if it hasn't been postmarked, is February 18th. Early voting ends February 25th, and the last day of receipt for a marked ballot by mail is March 1st, which is Election Day. And there are some other stipulations. I'm not going to go into all of it, but you can go to thinkwingradio.com. It's one of the main items in the show post. Or you can always go to harrisvotes.com or go to your particular elections clerk and see what's going on in your area. There was a thing that happened. I sent in my mail-in ballot application like the 25th of December.
Mm-hmm.
It was clear that it was an application for 2022 because all the days and dates jived with the year 2022.
Mm-hmm.
The last few years that I have been getting a mail-in ballot, I have always tried to mail it in just a little early so that I'm basically on the mail-in ballot list as of January 1st. Well, not this year. And I suspect that has to do with Senate Bill 1, which was the unnecessary voting integrity bill, so-called. They kicked out my mail-in ballot application. I got a phone call from the Harris County clerk saying your ballot application arrived too early and therefore we cannot accept it. Now, you may have heard like half of ballot applications have been rejected in the state of Texas, including Harris County. So they said, we're sending you a new application, which theoretically I would have to fill out again and mail in again and use another postage stamp again. Now, as it happens, I fill it out on my computer. So I go online, I have the form, I use Adobe Acrobat, and I save what I filled in. The only thing I don't fill in is the date and the signature. So for me, this was pretty easy. But for another person to have to fill out the form again by hand, You know, some people just go the heck with that. You know, yeah. I did my civic duty once, and I'm just not going to go through filling that form out again.
Yeah.
So let this be a lesson to you. If you can, fill it out online or fill it out using something like Adobe Acrobat or similar, and save the form you have filled out in case you have to reprint it.
Yeah.
Same thing happened to my wife, by the way, because I tell her, now make sure you send in your mail-in ballot application. And, of course, hers kicked back also. So, yeah, this when you see 50% of ballot applications for mail-in were rejected, your host was one of them.
Mm.
Okay, our next story, and I'm going to be catching up on some stories from the last couple of weeks, where appropriate. From communityimpact.com from December 30th, Harris County Commissioner Tom Ramsey looks ahead to 2022 in Precinct 3. As 2021 came to a close, Harris County Precinct 3 Commissioner Tom Ramsey recapped 2021 and discussed his priorities heading into 2022 during a December 16th interview with Community Impact newspaper. 2022 brings changes. Oh, something slipped, sorry. Paper. Can't live without it. Can't burn it. 2022 brings changes for Ramsey as redistricting this fall flipped much of Precinct 3 and Precinct 4's jurisdictions. The transition is slated for completion in March, basically in about 10 weeks. What would you say, the question from the interviewer, what would you say are some of the biggest accomplishments in Precinct 3 over the past year, Commissioner Ramsey? Ramsey says, we walked into the year with certain priorities, and we've really been able to make significant gains in all of those. One of them was lowering taxes. When we met in October to set the tax rate, we not only lowered the taxes in terms of the tax rate, we reduced the tax revenues in terms of the amount of money that the county was taking in from taxes. Infrastructure is going to be a focus in 2022. The other corollary to that is to do with the money to support that. Anyone get a contradiction there? Kind of an oxymoron. But I will proceed. It seems like every meeting we come up with a new program. Many of them are well-meaning. Many of those are social programs, and I'm not opposed to that in every case. But I'm telling you, every dollar that's spent on a new program is a dollar that's not spent on infrastructure. We've also got to get I-45 started back up. That's the road that's been paused because it might mess up minority communities, perhaps unnecessarily. The county sued Texas Department of Transportation to stop it. I've tried to convince my colleagues to drop the lawsuit. They've paused it, and TxDOT has been more than accommodating. But if we're not careful and we don't do something quickly, TxDOT's going to take that $9 billion and move it to Dallas or Austin or San Antonio. There is more to this story. So this is the excerpt that I thought was interesting to discuss. What I feel it clearly shows is the distinction between the Texas Republican philosophy of governing versus the liberal Democratic philosophy of governing, and therefore demonstrates the degree to which elections have consequences. Ramsey is clearly from the doing more with less school of government, which I say always leads to an expectation of doing everything with nothing form of government. He's dedicated to infrastructure and references bond money, but he's obviously against tax revenue, which, interestingly enough, is necessary to pay off bonds. And against tax revenue going to social programs, Ramsey is, though he's not opposed to that in every case, he says. It really comes down to the old Grover Norquist philosophy of shrinking government until it's small enough to drown in a bathtub. Some infrastructure does also qualify as social programs, such as water, waste, and power grid infrastructure. Some social programs are to help people lift themselves out of poverty, which in the long term is good for society and business overall. And just FYI, reducing poverty usually equals increasing tax revenue, since the formerly poor people spend more money. Unless you're a Republican, reducing tax revenue is not an unadulterated good, since you get the government you pay for, or at least you don't get the government you don't pay for. It will be interesting to see what Harris County government looks like after the next election cycles in the commissioner's court. Andrew?
Well, what really strikes me about this interview is Ramsey's outlook on the I-45 project. He says, I don't think you read this, but he says, this misrepresentation of what TxDOT is doing and will do is not right. It's not a misrepresentation. The objection that people have with it is that the plan for the interstate is going to is not taking into account, you know, the layouts of neighborhoods, the flow of people between those neighborhoods, and the access of those people to goods and services that they need to survive. Like, it's,
or for that matter, the homes, apartment units, and businesses that will have to be
demolished,
in order to build parts of the road.
Absolutely,
which, you know, is damage to the community.
Yeah. And further, he talks about TxDOT's going to take that $9 billion and move it to Dallas or Austin or San Antonio. And to me, that just sounds like he sees governance. He sees his term in office as a game with a score. And that score is how much money can he get spent on infrastructure? And that, you know, it doesn't matter if that's, you know, local money. It doesn't matter if that's state money. How much money can he get spent on infrastructure, and how much of that can he not get to come from taxes? And that seems, not only did you point out that those are two completely contradictory goals.
Because tax money pays bond debt.
Exactly. They're not even good governance. They're not even focused on, you know, keeping people alive, or, you know, making sure people have a place to live or food to eat or schools to send their kids to. You know, it's not good governance. It's not competent.
And when
governance.
They don't have the money to do those things, it actually is worse for business, and it's worse for tax revenue, and it's worse for the state.
Yeah.
Just from a strictly mercenary standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. Just from a total self-interest standpoint. So, you know, I think this is really quite the insight into the mind of conservative governance and elected conservatives. Because,
well, to be fair, I would say Ramsey in particular, conservative governments in general.
Mm.
I would also point out that he ignores the fact that, you know, the phrase "living on the wrong side of the tracks."
Mm-hmm.
It's not because one side of the tracks happens to be the wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah.
My impression is that the tracks are put through town so that one side is the wrong side of the tracks, and the tracks act as a barrier to getting on the right side of the tracks.
Yeah.
So these things, you know, there can be perfectly good engineering reasons to why roads and railroads and streets follow certain paths. Mm-hmm. But historically, they have followed the path of least resistance, which is the path of least political power.
Yeah.
So that tends to disadvantage poor, white and communities of color.
Yeah.
Okay. Are we ready to move on to the next topic?
I think so.
From communityimpact.com, the Tomball City Council discusses potential uses for the American Rescue Plan Act funding. Now, we won't talk about the uses for the Fund Act are probably in the title, American Rescue Plan, but I digress.
Mm-hmm.
Tomball City Council discussed potential uses for the funding it received from the American Rescue Plan Act. Tomball will receive a total of $2.92 million, half of which it has already received. The remaining half will come during 2022. The proposed uses, and this is very interesting. This turns into another story of you know, that elections have consequences. You get the government you vote for and pay for. The proposed uses for the money include providing grants to nonprofit organizations, replacing lost hotel occupancy tax revenue, which makes sense, improving the Tomball Historic Depot, like train depot, I guess, maybe bus.
I think so, yeah.
And replacing which ones, a train or bus?
Train.
Train, I think, yeah, typically. And replacing the city's water and gas meters. An agenda item to spend $1.7 million of the funds on replacing the meters was tabled at the meeting, Community Impact newspaper previously reported. Director of Public Works Beth Jones said the water and gas meters are a critical part of the city's infrastructure. I might infer from this, this is me speaking now, that A, you want meters to work accurately, and B, it helps if you have modern meters that can be read, turned on and off remotely. It saves money. It saves manpower. It ultimately pays for itself. Beth Jones said the water meters and gas meters are critical. She said city staff focused on the project as something that could be addressed using ARPA funds. The city also proposed using $100,000 to provide grants to nonprofit organizations. The remaining $527,437 would be used for improvements to the Tomball Historic Depot. Arguably, they might make a case for that with, say, private business funding.
Yeah.
Anyway, Assistant City Manager Jessica Rogers said the city, the money allotted for improvements to the depot was simply what was left over of the ARPA funding after budgeting for grants, hotel tax revenue replacement, and the water and gas meter replacements instead of for any specific project. Again, I will note, but they didn't seem to make any effort to take some of that $527,000 and put it into nonprofit grants. Just saying. Council member Chad Deggies, and I hope I pronounced that name close to right, said he would rather see the city use regularly budgeted funds for improvements to the depot rather than ARPA funding. Deggs said that he would like to see the city use the funds to help small businesses and residents of the city. And you see, that's the kind of guy I would probably vote for. City Council did not approve any uses of the funds during the meeting, but will come back with resolutions to spend the funds later at later City Council meetings. Now, the city, I checked on this. I try to be, you know, accurate, and I try to dig a little further. City of Tomball elections are like Houston. The elections are nonpartisan. So when you run for office in the city of Tomball, you don't have an R or a D or a G or an L or anything else next to your name. That is according to their own official website. Now, why am I not surprised by this? I wonder how successfully we could pick out the party affiliations of the individuals referenced in this story, which is why I am totally all for partisan local elections. In my opinion, it's a truth in advertising issue.
Yeah.
I mean, most people are running under a D or an R or an L or a G or an I for independent. That immediately tells you something about where they stand because they'll affiliate themselves with a party that they feel will support their views and their agendas. I think it's clear from the way they govern which parties they affiliate with. I think it needs to be clear during the election which parties they affiliate with. Andrew?
Absolutely. But as for the rest of the story, you know, $1.7 million seems like a lot for water and gas meters, but without Build Back Better, I guess this is the only option that they have for infrastructure funding. And while I like historic preservation and trains, I think a better use for that spare $500K would be something like, I don't know, paying people's rent and utilities or setting up food deliveries for immunocompromised people. I mean, we do have this.
Or job retraining.
Or job training or any other kind
of. Any number of things.
Yeah. You know,
any number of things. And the fact that the depot allocation is over five times the nonprofit is just breathtaking. I mean, the open arrogance of that. When something like that, if it's going to take state funds, it should obviously take state funds at a lower priority than human welfare.
Yeah.
And obviously should be attracting some private nonprofit grant money from, you know, charities that have a lot of money to offer for things specifically like historic preservation of buildings. There are charities that are for that specific thing.
And even pursuing private donations from, like, you know, prominent members of the community. You know, people love to get their names engraved on those bricks, you know, that people will put into buildings or on the floor, you know. So
$1,000 brick is readable. A $500 brick is underneath the $1,000 brick, which is kind of the strata of society. Okay, time for our first break, if I may. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central Time. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org from literally anywhere in the world. podcast it on your phone's podcast app, which is something I recommend. You can go to past shows of Thinkwing Radio and one of perhaps 100 other shows on KPFT by going to archive.kpft.org. KPFT is Houston's community station, which means that we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. And believe me, when you have over 100 show titles, that's a lot of variety. You can go to the new kpft.org webpage. It is actually new. And hit the donate button. Pick your favorite show, maybe ours. I should name it Thinkwing Radio, just so you know. And the amount of your donation, whether large, small, or in between, whatever you can give is appreciated. You may qualify for a lovely thank you gift. You can also donate by texting the word give, G-I-V-E, to 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738, the word give. Or you can just spread the word. You know, word of mouth helps, too. If you have a show or a couple of shows that you particularly like and you can mention them to other people and maybe those people sample them and help grow our audience, that's a helpful thing, too. So whatever you can do, large, small, medium donation, mentioning word of mouth. Donations are tax deductible, by the way. Word of mouth doesn't cost you anything, so the IRS doesn't permit you to deduct for that. Our next story, Montgomery County accepts, and this was a shocker, they accepted Operation Lone Star grant money to reimburse costs at the southern border. This is what we took from the story. Montgomery County commissioners accepted a grant from Texas's Operation Lone Star Fund at a January 11 commissioners' court meeting to reimburse county jailers who traveled to the U.S.-Mexico border to assist state forces in detaining undocumented immigrants. The amount accepted on January 11th was $154,000 and change. At the October 26th session, Montgomery County Sheriff Rand Henderson told the commissioners that the reimbursement would cover salaries and overtime of personnel who had assisted state forces at the border. Henderson confirmed that the county's operations actually cost $400,000 in total, and that as of the end of October, no county forces remained at the border. Now, my first reaction to this headline, which I think I've already expressed, is what is Montgomery County doing spending money at the southern border? If I were living in Montgomery County, I'd be livid that my county tax dollars went toward the border. And I would be outraged that Texas relief funds were used to pay for it. It would seem to me that border control is like a state and federal issue, not necessarily in that order. But, you know, Texas wants to be a country. And I guess that makes all the counties metaphorical states. But it's just wrong. That's just wrong. Yeah. Andrew, anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, it's not even to mention the ethical and moral argument. You know, border enforcement is just as inhumane now as it was when Trump was in office, and the U.S. is still destabilizing foreign governments and causing people to flee those conflicts. And where do they end up? They end up here. As long as those things are true, border enforcement will be just plain wrong.
Although, to be fair, it's not necessarily the United States. I'm not going to say not corporations, but it's not necessarily the United States destabilizing, say, Central American countries. It's the Central American countries need help to stabilize themselves, which is also something that Trump didn't do while he was preventing refugees from fleeing for their lives. But anyway.
Well. We're going to disagree on that.
I know we are, and I'm going to allow myself to get the last word. But, you know, just whatever. Anyway, in case you hadn't heard, this is from the Texas Tribune from about a week ago. Shelley Luther, an anti-lockdown activist and GOP candidate for the Texas House, said Chinese students should be banned from Texas universities. Luther became nationally known at the beginning of the pandemic in 2020 when she refused to shut down her Dallas salon in defiance of emergency orders. She was sentenced to a week in jail, but was released after only a few days, no doubt for bad behavior. Chinese students, she said, should be banned from attending all Texas universities. No more communists, she said in a tweet. In a follow-up tweet, she said, that the state's taxpayers, quote, should not be subsidizing the next generation of CCP leaders, referring to the Chinese Communist Party. In a subsequent tweet, she said it is, quote, common sense that the CCP leaders, quote, should not have access to our schools. On Friday of that week, State Senator Jean Wu, a Democrat from Houston who is Chinese-American, condemned Luther's comments and asked her to publicly apologize. He said Luther's statements are ignorant, hateful, and incite violence against not only Chinese-Americans, but all Asian-Americans. To casually conflate all Chinese students in America with actual registered members of the ruling party in the People's Republic of China is not only ignorance of an extreme nature, it is also the type of rhetoric that drives anti-Asian hate crimes. Republican leaders were virtually quiet about Luther's tweet. I'm shocked. But one Republican in the Texas House, Republican J.C. Jetton of Richmond, who is Asian American, tweeted Sunday that the GOP, quote, should stand against, and this phrase got me, should stand against canceling Chinese students on college campuses. Now, interesting that Shelley Luther doesn't seem to have any vocalized problem with, say, Russian students working for Putin or allied with Putin coming to Texas universities. There's no problem with letting them go to Texas universities. And I guess Jetton's use of the phrase canceling Chinese students is really a weird use of Republican anti-liberal jargon. Andrew?
Well, I would say that, you know, she's not objecting to Russian students coming to Texas universities because Russia is a capitalist country. But this is a This is a candidate for public office openly calling for discrimination on both racial and political grounds when U.S. law forbids policy like that. Yet she is still on the ballot. It's almost like the U.S. government doesn't mind discrimination that much.
Well, we won't know until and unless she's elected, but we know where the Republican Party stands. Okay, next story from KUT News, Texas Tribune. Texas says supply chain issues have limited the number of voter registration forms it can give out. Sam Taylor, Assistant Secretary of State for Communications, said supply chain issues have made it harder and more expensive to get paper, which means the Secretary of State's office will be giving out fewer voter registration forms to groups ahead of elections this year. Grace Chemaine, the president of the League of Women Voters of Texas, said in previous years her group had been able to get enough forms to pass out at naturalization ceremonies. Often, she said, the group partners with the state to give out several thousand forms at each ceremony. Taylor said the Secretary of State's office had been forced to limit each group to 1,000 to 2,000 registration forms per request. He said this shortage is coming at a time when many groups are seeking out new voter registration forms because of a change in Texas's voter registration laws created under Senate Bill 1, a controversial voting law that went into effect last month, and by the way, which may really have been entirely unnecessary except for the purposes of voter suppression. Taylor further said in a statement Tuesday, while we have made clear to officials and groups that they should not be distributing the old version of the voter registration form, county voter registrars may accept completed voter registration applications on the old form so long as the application is otherwise valid. In other words, using last year's form in and of itself is not fatal to the voter registration application. There's a lot of heavy loading on qualifying words there. Chemaine said all these constraints present serious issues for her group as they try to get voter registration materials together ahead of these large naturalization ceremonies. According to Chemaine, this is one of the pitfalls of Texas being among the few states in the country that does not have online voter registration. Supply chain issues, kind of a catchphrase, are not as big of a problem when you can just direct someone to a website, or if you don't force them to unnecessarily use the new forms that are in short supply when the old forms might be acceptable. I mean, it was kind of left like, maybe.
Yeah. Andrew? Well, I would say that this would also not be a problem if we had automatic voter registration, which is one of the good parts of the Freedom to Vote Act. So
precisely that. Excellent. Okay. Next story. is, well, it's not really from anybody in particular. It's sort of combined from a number of sources, because I feel like the filibuster is such a big news story in and of itself. I thought we would try to delve into it. But an interesting thing happened in the process of delving into it. We found that even though we went through, it looks like, six different stories relating to the filibuster, past, present, and potential future, there were questions that were left unanswered to such a degree that this is what we have boiled it down to. About 1806, then Vice President Aaron Burr, and that is the guy who shot Alexander Hamilton, and by the way, later was accused of treason to the United States, that Aaron Burr, suggested eliminating the motion to end debate in 1806. From our reading, we don't know what his motivation was for doing this, but the motion to end debate wasn't replaced with anything. We also don't know why the Senate decided to approve that rule. We don't know what their motivations or reasons were either. So this is one of those big sort of black holes in history that apparently doesn't explain itself. So after that, debate essentially could never be forced to end. So debate could hold up motions forever unless a motion was withdrawn. That is essentially the filibuster. In 1972, Senate rules were changed to allow two pieces of business at once, what they call the two-track system. This allowed one bill to be filibustered while the other legislative business was being conducted. Now, I want you to imagine the two-track legislative system where someone says, I'm going to filibuster, and then the ghosts of filibuster past go into endless filibuster, while the breathing, blood-pumping humans conduct whatever business the Senate deems worth conducting. So the two-track system is the ghost filibuster and the actual legislative business of the Senate. One of the things that may happen this week, we've kind of been trying to follow it, it's a little dense, but from an interview that I listened to on Lawrence, apparently the Schumer strategy is on Thursday he's going to bring, they've been having a debate under a special motion, they've been having a debate on the merits of these bills, and there will be a cloture vote on Thursday to allow to end debate, to permit debate, something like that. And if they cannot get the 60 votes for cloture, which no one expects they will, then Schumer is going to propose a modification to the filibuster that I did read is specifically for these two bills. So it will be a carve out, not just for voting legislation, but for this particular voting legislation.
Okay.
And that carve out will require a standing speaking filibuster, where every senator would have the opportunity to speak twice, and once all the opportunities to speak were used up, there would be a simple majority vote on the bill.
Okay. Okay.
So that's kind of the deal. We have basically provided links to our various sources, ranging from HarvardPolitics.com to the Brennan Center, to NPR, to CNN. And perhaps you can make more of it than we did, but it seems that for all the explanation, there's a lot not being explained. So the history is kind of vague. It's only the results that we really know. Andrew?
Yeah, so just for absolute clarity, this proposed talking filibuster is not going to apply to voting rights legislation, and it's not going to apply to all Senate business in general. It is just going to apply to presumably the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the Freedom to Vote Act.
It will be specifically for those two voting bills, no other voting bills unless another exception is carved out.
Okay. All right. Interesting.
And I guess the hope is that Manchin and Sinema will see this as a limited carve-out that doesn't violate the spirit of the filibuster, in fact, brings it back closer to what it historically was, and that maybe they can be sweet-talk pretty, pretty, pretty pleased to allow the carve-out.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's political language, but, you know, whatever works.
Yeah, it may not be in a political science classroom, but, you know, it's
yeah, well, Pretty Please. You never know when Pretty Please will do it. Pretty Please with strawberries on top.
Yeah.
You know, Pretty Please with cannolis.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see if this, you know, sets a precedent for the Republicans to do a similar thing with, you know, a bill that they're in a similar situation with in the future, if that situation ever arises.
You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on Houston's community station, KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. You can also listen at kpft.org from anywhere in the world. We do have listeners on the West Coast in Canada. I've heard from them. Mm. You can also podcast the app, or rather podcast the show on your podcast app on your phone. You can also go to archive.kpft.org, where you can not only listen to past ThinkWing shows, but past shows from something like 100 other shows that KPFT carries and broadcasts. Music shows, talk shows, political shows, food shows, all kinds of shows. Now, keep in mind that when we do a show on ThinkWing Radio, because we're discussing lots of different articles and stories, every story on the show is necessarily heavily excerpted, which is why we provide you with links to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. Just go to the show posts tab at the top, click on that, go to the show date that you're looking for. You can also search for it in the search window that is available on the page. We're also available on social media. You can go to ThinkWing Radio on Twitter. Of course, it's at ThinkWing Radio. You can go to ThinkWing Radio on Facebook. You can email us at thinkwingradio@msn.com. And of course, Andrew has his social media.
I do. You can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE and spelled the same on Tumblr at dominatei.tumblr.com.
Okay, now we're going to go into one of our rougher segues, but it's a story that I think is worth reading. It's actually from November, from CNN Business, and what caught my attention was the video that I have linked to if you go to the website, but I'm going to read the article that they built around the video. So keep in mind, this is from November. Infrastructure Week, it's called, by the way, How the Media Mistakes a Slogan for a Story. Infrastructure Week is a cheeky slogan, but the real story is what the infrastructure funding in the Build Back Better bill will accomplish. CNN chief media correspondent Britt Stelter said on Reliable Sources Sunday that it's the media's responsibility to report the story, not just repeat catch-all slogans. Critical race theory is another example of a concept that's become a rallying cry, a slogan. The activists who tried to take critical race theory from a national story into a national slogan, Stelter said, they knew what they were doing. They were trying to create a boogeyman, and it worked. Natasha Alford, vice president of digital content at the Griot and CNN, a political analyst, said the media, in an attempt to answer questions, often falls into a trap of repeating phrases that are put out there to intentionally derail public dialogue. I will add, in my opinion, Republicans for decades now have been great at focus grouping such phrases for maximum effect, which is, and then they're very disciplined about repeating the same phrase in every interview, in every medium, in every state or congressional district or state, state house, state legislature, until the Republican focus grouped phrase becomes the definition of the issue they're discussing, which already frames the issue.
And as an example, death tax, which is the, you know, Republicans' euphemism for the estate tax, which is actually a very reasonable concept, was literally created in a focus group. I've seen footage of the focus group where it was created. Like,
and actually the phrase entitlement was created by the Republicans rather than, say, the more accurate earned benefits.
Yes.
To make it sound like the government is giving people something, not that people are paying into the government to get something back later. Mm. Yeah, it's insidious. Mm. Going back to the story, when focusing too much on slogans, the substance of the news can get pushed out of the spotlight. An October CBS poll found that only 10% of Americans know the specifics, or I imagine any of the specifics, of the Build Back Better bill. Stelter said the format of news also can have an effect. Often users have to pay a subscription to gain access to substantial in-depth news, and too often complex issues such as critical race theory are portrayed in overly simplified black and white terms, which may be perfectly appropriate when you think about it. The media has also come under criticism for its reporting on the economy. I do want to point out that Andrew and I have discussed this issue of if you want news, you have to get past the paywall. If you mm-hmm. want fiction, you can find it anywhere you want.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that is, I think, a serious flaw in an information-driven society.
Yeah.
But in any case, the story goes on. There is a bad news bias where the media is attracted to covering the negative. Some of that bias just comes out the gate too soon, Alford said. I mean, it was not even 48 hours after Joe Biden's elected, and the media is asking, is he failing us? So my thoughts on this: perceptions that are both created and accepted by media and subsequently becoming common wisdom. Republicans have historically been particularly good at devising potent phrases and then having the party discipline to repeat them over and over across all the media until the media use those phrases as the definition of the topic they're reporting. I remember once there was an immigration show on KPFT, mm-hmm. and during the Trump administration, the Republicans had been trying to insert the term chain migration into the lexicon. Basically, so someone comes over and they get their dad over, and the dad helps the mother come over, and the mother helps the children come over. And the Republicans were calling this chain migration, whereas what typically it's called in the system is family reunification.
Yeah.
So you can see how insidious that was. And what got me to call the show was that the people that were against the term chain migration had found themselves using the term chain migration.
Mm.
So we actually ended up having a 20-minute discussion on the air about how they had managed to be essentially owned by the Republicans, or pwned, or whatever you call it because of the way it's spelled, that they had taken people pro-family reunification and gotten them to use the term chain migration. That's how insidious the process is. Andrew?
Yeah. I mean, you know, going back in the article a bit, you know, the infrastructure bill spending being spread out over 10 years, a whole decade, just to reiterate that, definitely wasn't often mentioned by the media. And I'll bet most people didn't know about the timeline. They just saw that it was going to be, you know, billions of dollars. And they thought, well, as soon as this bill passes, the Treasury is going to be emptied out. But that's not at all what's going on. You know, not to even mention that most critics of critical race theory haven't even read the Wikipedia page, probably. You know, we've talked about reliable info being locked behind paywalls before, like you mentioned. And I think that both shallow coverage and paywalling.
And by the way, I want to point out it was Andrew who brought that idea, that topic, that observation to the show.
It was. Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, we've talked about that kind of reliable info being locked behind paywalls. And I think that both shallow coverage and paywalling are consequences of the dominance of for-profit media. These are my own opinions, but this is what I've observed. You know, I trust nonprofit sources far more than I do for-profit ones, and I try to consume media from smaller, more obscure outlets just as much as I do mainstream ones. Fact-checking is definitely an important part of that, but it's an important part of all media consumption. CNN having lots of money doesn't make them more trustworthy than The Intercept, for instance. So, you know, I think there's not necessarily a whole lot that we can individually do to change the landscape of the media, but there's certainly changes we can make in our habits. You know, fact check all your sources, do the deep dives that the for-profit outlets don't have time for, and, you know, maybe throw a couple of bucks to nonprofit media like this station while you're at it.
And actually, I think nonprofit news is probably going to be the business model of the future. If news coverage is going to survive. And I think that if we can give subsidies to oil companies that don't need it, I think we should very much be giving subsidies to the news, the accurate dissemination of news and information that is the lifeblood of this country, something that oil has been described as.
And absolutely.
If oil can be a lifeblood, I think information for democracy, accurate information, certainly should be seen as a lifeblood, because I think that at least for the time being, reporting as a business appears to be not only a failing business model, but a business model that is failing the country.
Absolutely. You know, oil was the lifeblood of the country during the Industrial Revolution. But it's, you know, information is the lifeblood of the country during the information age. So
there shouldn't be a paywall against getting the truth.
Yep.
Okay. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 HD2, airing Wednesdays at 11 a.m. Central. Live online, kpft.org. You can podcast on your phone, or you can visit archive.kpft.org to listen to prior shows of Think Wing, as well as 100+ other shows on KPFT. Every show is heavily excerpted, which is why you can find links to the full articles, because we believe you should see the whole article, and you can decide whether I maybe unfairly edited or excerpted an article. That's your judgment to make. We are also on social media, where we can take questions, comments, and suggestions. The show has a Facebook page, Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig. I am on Twitter, at Think Wing Radio, and Andrew has his social accounts.
I do. You can find me on Twitter, at DominateEYE, and spelled the same on Tumblr, at DominateI.tumblr.com. And in light of the last story, you can donate to this station as well on KPFT.org.
Okay, our next series of stories are kind of linear. You'll see what I mean. They're basically going from science fiction to what we are maybe calling science faction.
Mm-hmm.
The robot workforce isn't coming. It's already here. And this is from CNBC.com, December. To cope with these changing times, retailers and restaurants are stepping up investments in robots and other technology. Walgreens is turning to automation to fill prescriptions, while Sprinkles and Starbucks move to swap out cashiers for tablets. Elsewhere, Walmart-owned Sam's Club is using robots to scrub store floors and scan inventory at some locations, and restaurant chains like Buffalo Wild Wings and White Castle are testing robots that can flip burgers or make chicken wings. Molly Harnischfeger, a director of the Consumer Insights team at Alex Partners, said companies are feeling more urgency as they struggle to find workers and pay higher wages. Plus, she said, shoppers and diners impatient with long waiting lines and other consequences of staffing shortages are becoming more open to robots and other technology. The retail and restaurant sectors have long been associated with high turnover and low wages, but with fewer workers now on the horizon, the industries are raising wages, sweetening perks, and even offering sign-on bonuses to recruit new hires, kind of like the military. Ron Hetrick, a senior economist for labor market insights firm MC, Burning Glass, said the labor shortage will outlast the pandemic. Many baby boomers retired early, and some people opted out of industries with higher levels of interpersonal interactions or chose a job that allowed remote work because of childcare challenges. At Walgreens, some prescription bottles are filled at centralized automated hubs rather than getting filled by an employee by hand at a store. With the pandemic, pharmacists and pharmacy techs have ramped up the patient care side of their tasks. They are doing COVID-19 tests and vaccines, along with filling prescriptions and answering questions about medications. Even beyond the health crisis, Walgreens was looking to turn stores into healthcare destinations and doctor's offices and other medical services. Josh Balin, vice president of product and marketing for Brain Corp, said companies have to get smarter about how they use their workforce. That means looking for monotonous, low-value tasks to automate, an approach that saves both money and makes jobs more enjoyable. Of course, it tends to make jobs more enjoyable for the people who have jobs.
Mm.
I think this is an interesting and inevitable process. You know, we have talked in the past about how China is facing a demographic cliff over the next 30 years due to their previous one-child policy. You know, declining population, declining birth rate in China is not a bug, it's a feature.
Mm-hmm.
The original intent was for the population of China to drop from a little under 1.4 billion to something around 750 million. Now the Chinese leadership has buyer's remorse because it's like, hey, 1.4 billion is a pretty good number when you need a lot of workers. While there is some governmental buyer's remorse at the policy success, it's actually working as designed. It's cutting China's population by the end of the 22nd century rather than doubling it. In the U.S., we are not facing a cliff so much as a slope, but it's been exacerbated by the pandemic, both by illness and earlier than planned retirements of baby boomers. So robots will be taking the place of missing workers. And what does that mean for low-skilled, previously essential workers and entry-level workers? Will there be places for them? What will the roles of government and business be in finding or creating those places? Andrew, I'm sure you have something you want to add to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem with replacing people with robots is if you don't have workers, you don't have customers. You know, as a union man, I know labor isn't going to take this lying down. The Industrial Workers of the World Union, which has a Houston branch, by the way, recently helped establish the first union contract at a fast food restaurant in the U.S. So service industry workers are fighting back against this kind of trend. And I know that anybody else who in any other industry who this, you know, the bosses try to do this to, I know they're going to fight back as well.
Well, you know, I might look at this from a different potential angle, not disagreeing with you in principle, but sure. If you have a shrinking workforce, which you will as baby boomers age, become increasingly disabled for work, become increasingly too old for work, in a way, they're kind of clearing a path for younger workers that up till now literally have felt blocked in promotions because the baby boomers just wouldn't get out of the freaking way. If after the retirement of baby boomers and creating higher level job positions for younger people that were being held back because the baby boomers just wouldn't die, you know, not to put too fine a point on it. So that leaves us with the so-called low-skilled workers who for the last year and a half were flattered with the phrase essential workers who are now learning, no, they're really low-skilled workers, not considered essential anymore. But, I mean, I think it's a crime for people to live their lives with a low level of skills. There are jobs that are needed for people with skills, and as robots take over the boring, monotonous jobs that a human can do, but it sort of destroys their soul, I think that makes it more important that society take on a role for so-called low-skilled workers and help them find skills that are more gratifying, more remunerative, and give better job satisfaction in life and earn them a better lifestyle. I mean, we can see this as an opportunity. You know, one of the things that I've referenced over time, over the last year and a half, is the Black Plague. The Black Plague did a very nasty job of eliminating about half the population of Europe. But it may also have been the beginning, like it or hate it, of European technological advance, enabling the machinery to explore the world, basically, to colonize the world. They had to invent machines to do the work of all the missing people. And the people that remained, according to archaeologists, those people show indications of being healthier, of being better fed. They were eating better food, better quality of food, better quantity of food. So, you know, these things are not all good or all bad. But what we're seeing is because you have a baby bust following the baby boom, we're going to have an opportunity to find ways to do menial, so-called menial jobs with machines and have a real societal opportunity to help everybody be their best selves. Now, that sounds idealistic, but that's not the same as being impossible, and it's certainly not the same as being undesirable.
I think that while it definitely sounds like a nice idea, I would say that, you know, the term low skill or no skill job is really not, it's a misnomer. There is really no work that does not require some kind of skill, that does not build some kind of skill.
Even ditch digging is better done smart than stupid.
Well, yeah, exactly. The more experience you have, the better you dig the ditch. I do believe this.
But if we can have ditch digging machines, maybe we can take the people digging ditches and teaching them higher performance skills.
Well, so
have better jobs and better support their families and have better lives.
Well, I do believe that, you know, for every job that is out there, there is somebody who enjoys it enough that they would want to do it day in and day out. There is some aspect of it that they enjoy, whether it's the satisfaction of hard work or the simple task that allows them to sort of unfocus their mind or whatever it is. You know, there are people who enjoy washing dishes, and there are people who enjoy cleaning houses, you know, these sorts of things. Not to say that everybody who does those jobs does want to do them the rest of their lives. But the other aspect of it is it really possible? Is it really practical to automate all this kind of work? And I'm not sure that it is, because, you know, there are only so many minerals to mine in the world. We probably haven't gotten anywhere near to even half of them extracted yet, but you know, we're going to run out eventually.
Our final story is kind of interesting. It's the first archaeological experiment in space from Flinders University. In a solar system first, an archaeological project has this week begun on the International Space Station. The Space Station Archaeological Project, or ISSAP, is the first archaeological study of a space habitat. Professor Walsh, an associate professor, says, "We're the first to try to understand how humans relate to the items they live with in space. By bringing archaeological perspectives to an active space domain, we're the first to show how people adapt their behavior to a completely new environment. While Earthbound archaeologists dig 1 meter squares to understand a site and strategize further study, the ISSAP team will use adhesive tape to define 1 meter areas of the International Space Station, and then use daily photographs to study how the spaces are used. I suspect time-lapse, which will be interesting."
Mm.
Set up by NASA astronaut Kayla Barron on Friday afternoon, the squares have been placed in a handful of locations representing work and leisure, including a galley table, workstation, express laboratory racks, and the walls right across from the latrine. As part of the experiment, the ISS crew themselves also chose an additional location for study based on their assessment of what would be interesting to document, with the final square placed on one of the racks in the U.S. laboratory module Destiny. The daily photography is now underway and will continue for 60 days. So on Earth, robots are taking over low-skill jobs, and in space, humans are still taking over medium-skilled jobs of computers.
Hmm. Yeah.
Or technology. So you just have to teach low-skilled job people to have higher skills that will improve their lives and make them a better fit for society. People can learn. Hmm. We have to be willing to help them do that. Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston, HD2. Houston's community station. My co-host, indispensable editor, and very patient fellow is Andrew Ferguson. We look forward to speaking to you again next week. Hope you found something interesting in this show to talk about before we see you again, and we hope to have some more interesting stuff for you by next Wednesday. You all take care. We'll speak to you next week. Bye-bye.
See you later.
This is DJ Tom Albright coming at you with the Jazz Latino HD show every Tuesday from 5 to 6 p.m. with Latin Jazz and Jazz Latin, followed by an hour of hot salsa dura made for your dancing shoes from 6 to 7 p.m. every Tuesday. And if that's not enough, the Jazz Latino HD show is repeated every Thursday from 10 a.m. to 12 noon. All that on Houston's community station, KPFT HD. D2, the veritably vital virtual radio source via the electron waves on the internet. Just go to kpft.org and scroll down. On the right side is the button to listen to HD2, or go to archive.kpft.org to listen anytime 24/7.